DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Kevin Starr, who holds an MA and PhD from Harvard University and a Master of Library Science from the University of California, Berkeley. He is currently a university professor and a professor of history at the University of Southern California, where he served for 15 years as a director of the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies. Dr. Starr's many articles and books, including Americans and the California Dream Series, has earned him a Guggenheim Fellowship. With Dr. Kevin Starr, we go inside the pages of Continental Ambitions, Roman Catholics in North America, The Colonial Experience, published by Ignatius Press. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
What a fascinating story, the church coming alive in the Americas, particularly
yes.
In our experience in North America. What led you to really want to dive into this particular aspect of history?
Well, in the course of my reading, I obviously went back to the four-volume history of John Gilmary Shea from the 1880s. And in the preface to one of those volumes, John Gilmary Shea emphasizes the point that the Catholic tradition and Catholic peoples represented the first projection of European Christianity to come to North America. And that's a very dramatic statement, because so often we Catholics define ourselves as an immigrant people, because we got this tremendous influx of immigrants in the mid-19th century from Ireland, from Poland, from Italy, from Germany. And that's important, and we should be proud of that. But we also have to remember that Catholic Christianity projected itself across the North Atlantic, as I bring out in my overture to the book, with the recently Catholicized Scandinavians, the Norse people, who settled in approximately the year 1000 in Greenland and thrived there for some 14 until the mid-1400s, and had a bishop, a cathedral, two monasteries, a clergy, and of course were only 6 to 10 day sail from Newfoundland, from the North American continent, where they would do business and where they established a base camp for about 12 to 14 years in the early 1000s. And then when you combine that with the projection of New Spain into the Spanish, what we call today the Spanish Southwest, or New France coming from 1610 down the to, well, actually 1535, the first exploration by French of the St. Lawrence Valley, and coming from the early 1600s into Quebec and Montreal, and then, of course, the Catholic colony of Maryland, you realize that, and this is no sense of competition, but that basically Catholic Christianity, Catholic peoples, Catholic were planted in this North American continent at an extraordinarily early age, early time, comparative to other traditions coming here. Now, this is not a triumphal statement to make, because, as I bring out in my book, in many cases, our behavior, and I say our, saying of Catholic peoples, mm-hmm. especially initial encounter with the Native Americans, was not everything that it should be in certain cases. But nevertheless, it's there. You cannot talk about the emergence of our modern North American civilization without starting with Catholic exploration, evangelization, and settlement.
It was very mission-oriented. Was
yes.
something that the reason it got the backing, the reason it moved forward, yes, the idea of acquiring land, maybe even political situations, but at the very heart of it, it was mission-oriented, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It never detached itself from evangelization. For instance, when Columbus came back from his first voyage, he brought back some slaves with him, enslaved Native America from the Caribbean. And Queen Isabella bawled him out and said, and it's very, very, very stressful to be bawled out by your queen, especially mm-hmm. when she's the one that sent you over there, said, I sent you over to evangelize these people, not to enslave them. And that tension between the fur trade and the development of mining culture, and the sort of normal economic development that the North American continent offered, played off against the dynamic of we are here to evangelize the native peoples and to join them in the creation, and this is very important, in the creation of a new Catholic culture in a new place, North America.
Isn't that fascinating that even in those tensions, those who would be the explorers, the ones who were seeking in a very real way a type of glory in the world, would bring along those missionaries who fought for in really justice and were seeking the greater good in many ways?
Yes. Well, of course, Chris, we Americans have a sense of the separation of church and state, and that's to the good, and we should sustain that. It's part of our American Constitution. But, of course, in the case of New Spain, in the case of Spain, France, and recusant England that went into Maryland, that was not a concept. Mm-hmm. These continental ambitions, that's the title of my book, because these continental ambitions were simultaneously sacred and profane, secular and transcendent. And we cannot detach one from the other. And as you suggest, as the soldiers, as the military leaders marched into the interior of the continent for exploration and for sometimes for conquest, they brought with them on an equal basis clergy who were there with another purpose in mind totally.
And I think those are the stories that are so fascinating that you bring forward. I mean, wasn't it Cicero that said that the person who doesn't know their childhood is destined to remain a child forever? And that's true.
Yes.
For societies and cultures.
No, it's very true. And I think the next formula to talk about now is, and I'm not just saying this because you're a woman or because more than half the human condition is a woman. Mm-hmm. The next thing to talk about is the role played by women, because without women coming into this world is initially a military, a male adventure. Without women coming into this world, then you do not have the creation of a laity. You do not have the creation of families, family life, and the creation of a diocesan clergy, and ultimately the coming of ordained, or in those days they would say consecrated bishops, to represent the fullness of the priesthood and on the seven sacraments for the lay population. So I trace also the development of the laity of Texas, of New Mexico, of California. I trace how the French had a program initially to educate Native Americans, young women, to marry French and to create a métis, a mixed culture, and that moved along with some success. And how Louis XIV's minister Colbert and his intendant Talon ultimately brought some 3,000, paid the way for some 3,000 young women who were farm women, younger than their older sister, had no dowries, so they would have to stay at home and live a kind of Cinderella life working for their older sisters. And the French said, now wait, come to America, come to the St. Lawrence Valley. If you meet a nice French gentleman and you get married, we'll buy him a farm on the St. Lawrence River. We'll pay your dowry. And that program had an enormous success over a 30-year period with some 3,000 people and created a new people flourishing to this day in both Canada and northern New England, the French Canadian people.
It's important for us to see how the different cultures came and assimilated, because the way that the Spanish came and their understanding of enculturation, of marrying within the culture, as opposed to maybe how the English approached their coming into the land, that would have huge ramifications.
Yes. There is some example of Catholic intermarriage with Native Americans, but very rare, very, very rare. One or two instances I bring up, because the English Catholics were like the Protestant Catholics. They tended to come over with men, women, and children.
Mm-hmm.
Families came over. You look at the Mayflower, it's families. In the case of New Spain, it took about 100 years for the Spanish, through Catholic marriages with indigenous peoples, for a new people to emerge, the Mexican people of today, or the New Mexican people, whom I concentrate on. And in the case of Canada, you have the two Catholics, three Catholic strains. You have because the French Catholic missionaries were extremely skilled with the Native Americans, dealing with them diplomatically. there's no example of major massacres or misbehavior in the French. That a few instances of that are not necessarily edifying, but you don't have systematic warfare. And so you had Catholic tribes. To this day, there are Catholic Native American Canadian peoples who remain Catholic from their earliest contact with the French. So the patterns differ in each case, but there is this amalgamation that I talk, this fusion of secular and sacred ambitions. Sometimes the sacred predominates, say in the case of the Jesuit missionaries going into Huronia and converting the Huron people. And certain other cases, say in the case of Las Casas standing up against the enforced labor of the Caribbean Native Americans, in certain cases the profane, the secular, the worldly ambitions predominate. You know, Catholic, because I'm telling a Catholic story, I'm not telling a story of perfect people. After all, mm-hmm. one of our seven sacraments is confession, i.e. that suggests that human beings are sometimes not everything they should be and should then say they're sorry and try and amend their life, which is a constant theme that I bring up. And as institutions mature, a kind of catholicity of culture begins to stabilize and form itself in the American Southwest, the Spanish Southwest, in California, in French Canada, in Maryland, and finally in southern Pennsylvania, because, of course, the Quakers were very open-minded and welcoming of other religious traditions.
Every aspect of this book, it's been difficult for me to put down because it is so fascinating, especially, I think, the understanding that we have of the different religious orders that would come in.
Oh, there's different philosophies. There's different theories of enculturation. For instance, the Franciscans were very much affected by their great Franciscan teacher, Duns Scotus, who tended to emphasize the ability of all human beings to accept religious truth, no matter what their cultural background was. So consequently, the Franciscans tended to think that the central act of Christianity, of becoming a Christian, is baptism. Well, that's true in terms of sacramental theory. The Jesuits, however, said, no, these are cultural. The Jesuits had already had by the time the Jesuits came here, they already had the experience of going into Japan. And so they knew that there was a process of enculturation, that they had to make sure that the words we used, meaning the Jesuits, are the same that the Indians understand. So they did an enormous amount of cultural studies. They did grammars. They translated the great prayers of Christianity into the Native American. And only then does baptism come at a certain point when the recipient is culturally mature. So there are different points of view. The California missions, for instance, were with the Franciscans. The Baja California missions and Arizona were under the Jesuits. And then, of course, dramatically in 1773, the Jesuits were suppressed. And so the mission culture tends to be for the remaining decades that last almost exclusively Franciscan.
That was one of those aha moments. It's like, oh, yeah, you cannot forget that what was occurring on the European continent in that expansion would affect what was happening in the Americas. And that Jesuit one, it's an important thing to remember.
It certainly is very important. I mean, after all, when the Jesuits were expelled from Mexico with the act of expelling the Jesuits from Spain, which happened just a little bit before the suppression, over 650 Jesuits were marched out of Mexico and the Spanish Southwest. That's an enormous amount of highly educated priests, brothers, novices. That's a major loss of clerical education and presence. But I try and be fair to all the orders. Now, for instance, the Sulpicians are not an order. They are a diocesan priest who teach in seminaries. And they founded a colony. The Sulpicians were crucial to the founding of Montreal, along with a woman, Jean Nance, mm-hmm. and founded Montreal. And the Sulpicians, in effect, were the sewers, were the lords of Montreal into the 18th century, up until the conquest. Then you have the Parish Foreign Mission Society. These are secular priests trained in Paris to go out to the mission countries. They came over. The seminary in Quebec was associated with them. And so you have the Paris Foreign Mission Society priests evangelizing and serving the Native American communities in the Illinois Territory, Upper Louisiana, Lower Louisiana. And, of course, the magnificent Ursuline sisters who came to Quebec in the 1630s, a century later, came to Louisiana, New Orleans, when that new city was founded, who dedicated themselves to the education of the young women, of the young Catholic women of North America. And the nursing sisters, too, the hospital sisters of the Mercy of Jesus that practiced in Canada. And during the, say, for instance, the conquest of Canada by French Canada by the English, those sisters nursed both English and French casualties.
I think that's so important for us to recall that, in at least the Catholics that are in the United States, we sometimes forget that there is this tremendous legacy of the church in all of North America. We sometimes think, well, we came over and we had Maryland, and that, and it's true, the very much the history presence within the British colonies was different, but on the entire continent, the Catholic Church was huge.
Well, yes, that's why the Catholicism plays a major role in founding regions which today we call Florida, we call Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. All that was all that region was fundamentally and consistently Catholic in its civic and cultural foundation, as well as its religious tradition. And so our sense of America today really needs, we Catholics, I think, and this is one of the motivations I have for writing Continental Ambitions, we Catholics should see ourselves as a profoundly historic people in the United States. Now, it should give us not a false pride, because when you become a profoundly historic people, you also have to take responsibility for the things that didn't go so well. For instance, Catholics were in the South were largely slaveholders, and that lasted really into and through the Civil War. Mm-hmm. We have to deal with that. I outlined some of the early attacks on Pueblo Indians that were perpetrated. So we have to take the good and the bad, but at the same time, that's history. History is a balance of those things. And we Catholics, it's important for us as we move in our present and future United States, that if we first regard ourselves as profoundly historic people, then our Protestant brothers and sisters will also do that. Because back in the 19th and 18th and 17th century, we were in dialogue with the larger Protestant majority in the English-speaking, but the Catholic majority in the Spanish-speaking and French-speaking areas.
Yeah, isn't it important, Kevin, too, as we are examining that period of history, again, to learn from that and reconciling and seeing the flaws, but also seeing the triumphs, that can be implemented into our dealings today, because we're not just people that are Catholics when we go into the church on a Sunday. It is a Catholic people that live in this world and function and do things.
Yes, exactly. Just look at the area where your broadcast is the strongest, Nebraska, Iowa, Wisconsin. Each of those places have a very powerful Catholic history. The Jesuits and the Sulpician missionaries were out to the Paris Foreign Missions out in Wisconsin. Iowa, of course, is a very early break off from the Eastern Diocese, and Loras College was founded in the 1850s. There isn't any area, to include the Oregon Territory, to include obviously the more remote Western states that aren't part of this early story, Montana, Idaho. There isn't any area that doesn't have a Catholic presence, a relatively early Catholic presence. And when you get into the East Coast and the Mississippi Valley, the Louisiana Territory, which we purchased in 1803, the Catholic tradition is the first tradition to have established itself.
It sets up more than just an opportunity to be able, I don't want to trivialize it, to be able to worship, but it's the whole identity of what it is to be a people that goes out in mission and lives it. So, I mean, it affects your laws, it affects your schools, it affects in the service that you provide those you're encountering. I mean, that's huge, isn't it?
It certainly is. And also modern movements, too, like the environmental movement. I trace in Kino, I trace in Pierre Boucher up in Canada, this growing sense on the part of Catholic culture and Catholics here as time unfolds, that the Lord has given us this great continent, how magnificent it is in its variety and power. These Catholic settlers, these Catholic explorers, went places that no one had been before. And being, as they were, very religious, especially the chaplains and the clergy that went along, there was a sense of gratitude to the Almighty that this grand continent should be here. Now, they had to, of course, delicately negotiate with the indigenous people. And in certain cases, it went better than others. I think, for instance, Texas has I mentioned already New France, with the exception of the Iroquois. The Iroquois and the French were at war for about 100 years, more or less. But when you look at Texas, when you look at New Mexico, after the initial trauma of Acoma, and the Pueblo Revolt, when you look at California, you see a very powerful Catholic DNA code, if you will, at work in the early period. And it attaches itself to the landscape as well, and it attaches itself to indigenous art. Look at the Santoses of New Mexico, which I talk about. They're beautiful statues and altar decorations that fuse indigenous themes with Hispanic themes into a new world statement. So I pay very close attention to art, and when I can, architecture. The great Church of San Xavier del Bac, founded by Father Kino in 1700 in Arizona. I pay attention to artistic traditions and to lineages that are affected in families as they develop over time.
Just in the last several years, there's been a greater awareness, again, of that good and of the challenges and of the bad. And part of those discussions came up around the canonization of Father Junipero Serra.
And absolutely.
We have to be careful, don't we, looking through things through our particular ethnocentric lens at that particular time in that particular culture. Don't we?
And we have to differentiate the mission systems. For instance, the Algonquin people of Maritime Canada, the Maritime Colonies, took very well to French culture. And Iroquois, when the Iroquois eventually converted to Christianity, both Anglican and Catholic Iroquois, because we have to remember Saint Kateri Tekathawa was an Iroquois woman. They adopted very well. The Texas and Native Americans from Texas, various Caddo peoples, did very well. In California, the devastating effect of European diseases on the Native American population cannot be overestimated. It's not that Father Serra woke up in the morning and said, like some say, oh, let's mistreat the Indians. But that encounter anthropologically between the Native Americans of California and the Spanish who came very late the Spaniards came very late to California, not till 1769, out to California, resulted in a kind of anthropological mismatch that had devastating effects. That's not true of the other mission systems. It's not true of the mission systems founded by Father Kino, the Jesuit in northern Mexico. It's not true of the great mission stations along the Mississippi River, the Missouri River, where today, of course, cities like St. Louis and New Orleans have evolved. It wasn't true with the encounter with the Native Americans of the Great Lake region, but the Native Americans of California were especially vulnerable. Serra fought for the Indians. In fact, when there was a group of Spanish soldiers who were sexually mistreating the Native American women of Southern California, Serra, even though he had marched into California with his bad leg, went all the way back to Mexico City to protest to the viceroy, Fray Antonio Bucarelli, who was a Knight of Malta, a professor religious, about this, and said something has to be done about this. Serra is a complex figure, and the ultimate success and or failure of the California mission system is very complex. Was animated by the same Franciscan desire to establish a protectorate for Native American peoples in North America that would contrast with the devastations of the Caribbean Native American peoples. That was their continental ambition. Now, they held on to it a little too long in California, and it, as I say, it had anthropological disjunctions, but nevertheless, it was motivated by grand ideas, grand ambitions.
Kevin, I wish we had more time, but that's the glory of people able to pick up a copy of Continental Ambitions. Any final thoughts?
Well, it's a privilege. You know, when one writes a book like this, you have to say to yourself, why am I motivated? Why do I think I can say this? I'm born in 1940. My parents were divorced. My mother wasn't able to care for my brother and myself. And so I was raised at a Catholic orphanage, the Dominican Sisters Mission San Jose, raised me at their orphanage, the Albertinium in Ukiah. So to a certain extent, I owe the church more than just an ordinary vote of thanks. I was part of the church's continental ambitions in the sense that to care for the orphans, to care for the homeless child was something that the church undertook, and the sisters, especially one the great nuns that are in my book as well, undertook. And so I think that psychologically, to a certain extent, I was able to do this book, and to say that I had the attention span and the right to do this book, because after all, I was raised by the church.
How wonderful, how beautiful, as you just witnessed to that.
You're the first one to get me to say, because I usually stay away from psychological conditions, but you're the first one to get me to say that I'm trying to pay back the church for raising me.
Well, that's a good thing to say. That's a good witness, and you're honoring that very, very well. I can't wait to volume two.
All right. Well, I'm halfway through now.
Dr. Kevin Starr, again, thank you so very, very much.
Well, thank you for reading the book with such attention and knowing how long we've been here, how well we've done, and where we did not do well, and the fact that American civilization, in its broader sense, would not be the same if we had not been here to bring our gifts to the creation of three great nations, Canada, the United States, Mexico.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the program.
With Dr. Kevin Starr, we've gone inside the pages of Continental Ambitions, Roman Catholics in North America, The Colonial Experience. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this conversation along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.